To my dearest friends, I am honored to bid you with the warmest of greetings upon this most cherished and festive of times for the closing of the year. The Imperium is a realm of a million worlds, and for those who dwell within hives found closer to their segmental cores, life might almost appear safe. The numerous industrial hubs, hive worlds, and logistical centers stand as the linchpins to the Imperium's strength, and given their importance, will be defended by dedicated regiments of the Imperial Guard, battle fleets of the Imperial Navy, and sometimes even chapters of the Adeptus Astartes. Witnessing the scale of such armies would certainly imbue a sense of majesty within the citizenry and would perhaps temper their fears of that which lurks in the dark. For how could any horror, however unfathomable, possibly stand against the military might of all mankind? But for those who dwell further out, cast amidst the most distant frontiers, their populace will often find themselves neglected, and in that woeful isolation, the shadows may seem but a little longer, and the nights a little darker. Yet no matter where they reside, the darkness will never seem so gloomy if they are to look inwards and hearken back to mankind's most cherished of traditions, taking part in a time of communal joy to embrace life, even if it feels so fleeting. This season, found at the end of the Terran calendar, goes by a thousand names across countless cultures, but at one point in humanity's ancient past, it was known simply as Christmas. In the 41st millennium, this season is celebrated primarily by observing the venerable time of Sanguinala, a festival which honors the noble Primarch Sanguinius, who fell so that mankind might endure for just a little longer. We know very little about how the varied worlds celebrate this occasion, as, of course, two planets on either side of the galaxy might interpret the event very differently. But we need to realize that Sanguinala is not the only holiday to mark this season. This is not necessarily from an official source, but upon the hive world of Necromunda, the populace is believed to take part in a celebration known as Fistmas. Supposedly, this is to remember how the Imperial Fists liberated the planet from its orky taint during the Great Crusade, and indeed, Necromunda has since become one of the two recruitment planets, exclusively used by the Fists. Most bizarrely, this holiday is just as cursed as it is blessed. As each year, coinciding with the festivities, the citizens of Necromunda will be forced to lock their doors, lest they fall victim to the monster, known as Fanta Claus. Legends say that it was originally a mutant creature, born out of the Ash Wastes, but that once the aforementioned orc invasion had been dealt with, the beast, along with an army of its peers, charged out to ravage the unsuspecting defenders. The Imperial Fists, indefatigable in their resolve, slaughtered the alien dregs, though one indeed survived the carnage, being able to infiltrate the Imperial lines, slicing through a number of legionnaires with terrifying ease. Rogal Dorn himself was said to have dueled this monster, finally bringing it to its knees. But before he delivered the killing blow, he had a most curious thought. He saw the devastated vistas of the hive and of the poor citizenry, and believed that perhaps this creature could be put to good use. He spared its life, ordering it and any of its surviving peers to collect any useful materials from the wastes, before passing them out to the weary humans as an annual tradition, which just so happened to coincide with Fistmas. This practice, however bizarre it may seem, apparently continues to this very day. And it has even been reported that some of these Fanta Claws have been hired by the local gangs. Though, as I said, this story is somewhat unofficial and should be taken with a hefty grain of salt. But regardless, during this festive season, many similarly peculiar tales have been known to circulate the hives. And so today, my dearest friends, I do believe that we should partake in these festive fables. So please, for the year's end, let us all sit back and relax as we hear of five more tales sourced from the ancient times of Christmas, retold for the grim darkness of the far future. Within the Imperium of Man, there is a saying, most commonly spoken by the members of the Adeptus Astartes, of "Suffer not the alien, the mutant, the heretic." Members of this dark triad have been responsible for practically every misfortune to fall upon mankind, and yet there is one which is occasionally given mercy by the Imperial Lords. All mutants are disgusting, but some can be rather useful, and perhaps none more so than of the mutant navigators who guide the great barges of the Imperial Navy. Most of their kind are feared, though are treated with some wary respect. But there are some whose mutations have diverged a little too far from the acceptable norm, and for them there can only be isolation, confinement, and eventually death. Such was the fate of Narius, a wretched, pale-skinned whelp born to the House of Calorant. Where most navigators possessed a gleaming, radiant warp eye upon their brow, Narius instead bore little more than a sunken cavity of twisting shadow, which seemed to ooze an otherworldly darkness with each passing moment. His elders labeled this as a null eye, branding him as an abomination, who would do little but tarnish the name of their ancient house. This wretch would never peer into the warp, and so, as an act of charity, possibly to garner some favor with their scrutinous agents, they passed him over to an inquisitorial vessel, a so-called black ship, where he would be taken to a fortress, imprisoned, and finally purged. And so, Narius was entombed within a stasis vault deep in the lower decks of the vessel, the aptly named Sanctity in Gloom, which silently vanished into the fathomless breadth of the cosmos. But whatever plans they had for the captive mutants were promptly dashed. As once the Sanctity slipped into the warp, a great storm suddenly bloomed around it. The cyclonic convulsions of unreality sent undulating waves in every direction and dimension, buffeting the vessel with such force that its Geller fields started to flicker. In that moment of vulnerability, the ship's command bay was racked by chaos, their navigator teams screaming out, their eyes burning as though lit by an inferno, until all four of their kind dropped to the deck, phosphorescent wisps of smoke gently forming from their hollow eyes. The vessel was lost to the warp, cast adrift to the currents of the storm, bereft of its entire navigator team, and cut off from all contact with the wider Imperium. The Inquisitor stationed at the helm, disgusted at his reliance on mutant scum, unfortunately came to the conclusion that without a navigator, their ship would only sink deeper into the Imperium. But it was at this point that he remembered that his vessel carried one very special prisoner. "Bring up the sealed one," he ordered. His retinue were loyal almost to a fault, nodding curtly as they turned face and marched down into the dark cells of the black ship. Deep below, past patrolling blanks and physically inert dwellings, they met with a wheezing servitor who cracked open the stasis tomb, allowing them to grasp Narius by the scruff of his neck and drag him out into the frigid light. The agents muttered about his eye, still sealed by an arcane helm at this point, and prayed that they were not about to turn their fates over to this mutant freak. Narius was thrown to the feet of their inquisitor, who was far too aware of the constant shuddering of their vessel, as though something vast and unseen was pressing against their hull, perhaps testing the integrity of their Geller field, like a finger running along the skin of a soap bubble. He grasped the mutant by the shoulders and lifted him up. "Guide our path, navigator. I shall spare you of your fate should you prove your worth." Then, with care, he unclasped his prisoner's helm, and for the first time in memory, Narius was permitted to fully open his null eye. The crew all saw it. They saw how the darkness within him spilled out in a thousand streams, twisting and winding through the air, meeting with every surface to deepen whatever foul shadows already stood, causing them to stretch, recoil, and dance. I can see it," he whispered, as his tears drifted through the air, forming into a channel of darkness, pointing through the kaleidoscopic lights of the warp.
You must follow the path."
And so they did. The ship lurched them from the turbulent barrage into a corridor of blackness, where the immaterium felt unnervingly still, stiller than even reality should have ever felt. But unusual as this was, it was certainly better than the storm, and the crew, though still on edge, momentarily believed their torment might actually be over. But as they moved further into the dark, they noticed how the colors of the warp melted away, and how, wherever they looked, they saw nary a star, nary a wisp of energy, nor even the faintest evidence that they were anywhere at all. The Inquisitor, blood turning frigid, as he realized the profound error of ever trusting a condemned mutant, roared for the ship to turn back. But it was too late. The darkness was already around them. It had already isolated them. The deck was submerged, the chamber walls long gone, as this tide rose and closed in further and further. Crewmates drowned in it, clawing helplessly at the last traces of light as they fell into sheer nothing. The Inquisitor, in his last moment, reached for his sword, but it was already gone. Narius, the null-eyed navigator, looked out one final time at the encroaching dark until the shadows flowed around him, and then he too was gone. Upon the world of Terra, long before it was encased in layer upon layer of artificial hive, it was known as Earth, and it experienced a range of distinct seasons, unlike in the 41st millennium, where its weather is mostly defined by varying levels of pollution. Nevertheless, there are many worlds in the Imperium which still retain their natural environments, but due to their local orbits, the strength of their sun, or some other curious reason, will be locked in a perpetual state of winter. These frozen ice worlds, no matter how desolate and frigid they may seem, will still revel in their festive seasons, even if the actual weather is no different from the norm. Upon one such planet, being of the glacial Agri settlement of Harder's Reach, their society was notable for two things. Firstly, for their subterranean hothouses, which used the volcanic activity of their world to heat the numerous crop stations, ensuring a constant supply of nutrition for the surrounding system. Secondly, however, was for a sanguinala tradition, where the children of the buried communities would climb up to the surface and fashion small effigies of the Winter Watcher out of snow, who was a harmless little folkloric figure said to watch over them through the darkest months. It was entirely innocent. But, as is so often the case for traditions in the 41st millennium, there came a year where that innocence was lost. That year, the triplet moons of Harder's Reach aligned into a rare and baleful configuration, forming a perfect triangle, partially eclipsing the bright sun at their center, which appeared to beam down a strangely cold light across the snowfields. This was written off as mere astronomical trivia, but the children, eager to outdo each other by building the largest watcher effigy of the season, took great delight in crafting their great guardian beneath that strange argent glow. They shaped him from the deep-packed snow of the southern drifts, sculpting their towering figure with long, sweeping arms of fallen branches, while small pebbles formed its cheerfully lopsided grin. Two polished lumps of coal became its eyes, and atop its bulbous head, the children proudly placed an old conical work helm, salvaged from an abandoned mining outpost. When they finished, they gathered around him, clasping their frost-bitten hands, and chanted their old settlement rhyme, a harmless nursery verse passed down through the generations. Watcher of winter, wake in the night. Guard us from hunger, guide us to light. How quaint it had always been, but beneath that pale moonlight, it certainly carried a different tune. Something within the snowman stirred. The coal eyes glinted, icicles down its arms flexed like tendons, and then, with a sound like distantly cracking ice, the snowman inhaled with a rattling, joyous gasp, and the children shrieked as it lurched into life. At first, it swayed, then hobbled about with the dexterity of a reanimated corpse, almost appearing to dance at one point as it ambled playfully after its cheering creators. Its voice, when it found one, was surprisingly warm for something carved from frost.
Children, friends, fun,
it boomed, the words tumbling together with naive exuberance. But soon, joy was not enough. The snowman, perhaps from all its efforts, had discovered hunger. The last the children saw of their frosty friend was of it suddenly bounding off into the night, vanishing amidst the darkness as its tracks were covered by falling snow. It began with the hardy surface-dwelling livestock torn from their pens, the farmers discovering naught but blood and ragged fur left scattered through the fields. Then their watchdogs went missing. The hounds all witnessed barking in a mad panic before darting away to chase some unseeable creature of the night. And then, as a particularly fierce storm raged, the children vanished, all of them dancing and singing into the oppressive dusk, never to be seen nor heard from again. The populace, sending searching teams, found nary a trace of their kin, but several swore that they sighted some swollen beast, some colossus of stratified ice and snow, dragging itself over towering seracs and across windswept snowfields. Panic gripped the settlement. They rushed to contact the nearby planetary defense regiment. The 812th Haders Reach Infantry, barely able to speak aloud the name they had given this monster of the Frost Fiend. The guard, wary of becoming swept up in the hysteria of a frontier world, presumed this to be one of the native ursine creatures preying upon the surface settlement, and so mustered a small unit and marched into the storm-belching night to put their kin at ease. They found it rather quickly, but at first they didn't even realize it. The guard planned to circle a gigantic glacier in their path, but as they stepped closer, the great structure rose up, towering above them like a titan, eyes of jet gleaming, before its mouth split open and it crashed down to swallow them whole, plunging them into the darkness of that yawning cavity. It was chaos. It felt as though they had been hit by an avalanche. Over half their squad had been crushed, while the survivors rushed to switch on their flashlights, clambering about, slipping and sliding through the icy labyrinth of the monster's interior. Their desperate vox signals bounced off of the frozen walls, distorted sounds ringing as their surroundings cracked and split, streams of frigid water gushing from overhead breaks. Some of the men drowned. Some of them saw their squad mates already frozen within the ice, but others swore they could hear something beckoning them to tread deeper through the cold. It was there, at the core of this monstrosity, that their resolve was irreparably broken. There, standing upon a platform of crystalline ice, were the lost children. The very same who had built the original snowman, eyes glowing pale blue, smiles wide and glassy. Their skin was coated in a dazzling layer of frost, but their voices were just as harmonic as ever, as they chanted the old rhyme, though not a single one of the guard noticed how subtly it had changed. Watcher of winter, grow in the night. Feast upon fire, smother our light. The guardsmen fired. They knew not why, only that these abominations had to die. But the frost fiend closed around them, and by dawn, only scattered scraps of flak armor remained, frozen in the snowfields, accompanied by the faint sound of festive song heard echoing over the wind-swept field. Sanguinala, as widespread and popular of a festival as it is, was always a difficult thing to celebrate within the lower tiers of Hive Palatine Theta. The maintenance servitors rarely tinkered with their crumbling infrastructure, with the lights of the upper spires never reaching this far down, and the air, thick with chems and dust, often dampened any hopes of communal festivity. But deck by deck, the people still tried, pinning their crude red badges to ragged coats, lighting thin lamps in honor of the Imperium, and praying to the Emperor that the season might pass without catastrophe. But it was on deck 34 that the miracle first appeared. A stranger, draped in a long, dark coat, seemed to drift through the crowds, confidently moving from place to place with a strange sense of calm. No one had seen him before, and so none could say where he lived or what role he played within the hive. But within the following days, stories began to circulate of the strange benefactor who seemed to avert misfortune wherever he walked. A stacked and malfunctioning hab loader on the verge of collapse held firm as the stranger touched its frame, which he jovially repaired with his own two hands. A child about to slip from a gantry railing found herself gently pulled back from the edge, while a starving family was provided with rations, even after the officials claimed they were all out. The citizens of the Underhive, always suspicious of interlopers, softened slightly, seeing his presence as a form of blessing to their often forgotten existence. But kindness in these forgotten reaches is always to be repaid, one way or another. It is not uncommon for people to go missing within a hive city, especially within the forlorn underhive, but what is unusual is for those lost souls to return home. A number of citizens from Deck 34 were reported as missing, and naturally the community wrote them off as either dead or having joined in a hive gang. Until, of course, they simply walked back into their old lives as though nothing had happened. They had no real explanations as to their brief disappearance, simply reassuring their kin that everything was fine and that they needed to get on back to work. Strangely, though, they all gravitated towards the new stranger, assisting him in his benevolent acts towards the community. They worked together, fashioning similar robes to distinguish themselves as helpers, before setting out to continue granting small mercies to their struggling families. But this, in of itself, this sense of community, this cultish behavior, was most suspicious. Proctor Varan, a stiff-jawed enforcer with no patience for unusual activity, launched an investigation into the growing movement. Not a single eyewitness could give evidence that anything was suspect, and in fact, the community seemed resoundingly in favor of the new movement, which Varan had to admit was generally uplifting the miserable existence of the impoverished hive dwellers. He was almost prepared to write off his investigation as null. Almost. That was until he saw the scampering. It was only for a moment, just in the corner of his eye, but he could have sworn he saw someone squeezing between two dilapidated buildings. That gap would have been far too narrow for most people, but on closer inspection he saw the deep scratch marks, the worn-down metal. Despite its size, people were clearly coming and going in great numbers. Taking out his shotgun, he kicked down the door to the leftmost house, finding it abandoned. But there, in the corner, as he parted an innocuous curtain, was a small shrine, and behind it, a passageway, leading downwards into a mysterious gloom. He couldn't hesitate. His suspicions had clearly been correct. Yet he had to know for sure what this was, what this shrine was for, and what lay at the end of the tunnel. He moved down, crouching low as the passageway narrowed, clawing through what felt like a maintenance shaft, clearly long abandoned by the planetary lords. It spiraled, the walls slick with moisture and discolored by growths of dense moss, squelching beneath him as he pulled himself further down. The air was hot, steamy even, such was the humidity, but through the haze, his light showed small symbols, scratched and carved around him, dug with the same depth as the claw marks he found by the entrance. But then he fell. The passageway collapsed beneath his weight, sending him crashing down into a candle-lit chamber littered with bones, and at its center, a vast throne, atop which he saw a monster, an alien beast, sided by the robed stranger. Indeed, he had never actually witnessed him with his own eyes, but had heard testimonials from the citizens above that he was just a benevolent imperial passing out charity to his new home. But he was hardly human. His skin was blotched with growths, his malformed face split by a chitinous crest, his mouth brimming with glinting fangs. He looked more like the alien upon the throne, that four-armed monstrosity, gargantuan in its hideousness. Varan looked around in panic, fumbling for his shotgun, seeing more half-human mutants crawling towards him. But the beast reached him first. It grasped him and lifted him to eye level. It only took a moment, but he felt his mind unravel as the unfathomable magnitude of the alien consciousness invaded his feeble thoughts and imparted on him the truth. It was beautiful. Salvation was coming. In a year's time, come the next festival of Sanguinala, the Star Children would descend, bearing their gifts to uplift the forgotten dregs of all mankind into a new plane of existence. But they would be opposed. The Lords would not believe them. He had to act. He had to prepare the world. He had to overthrow them. He had to fight. They had to lead the revolution. Only the stranger could guide them. And only the alien could be trusted to shepherd their hive towards that day of liberation. The orcs, those green-skinned brutes who infest near every corner of the galaxy, don't really have holidays, as the only thing they seem to celebrate, and the only event worthy of festivity, would be of getting stuck in with a good scrap. In truth, even the rare tradition of squigmas is little more than an excuse to brawl and batter one another. But upon the feral world of Skander's Rest, their raucous season would be marked by an omen most profound. A blinding green flare erupted across the night sky, streaking downwards in a brilliant arc that dazzled the disparate tribes, setting off half a dozen accidental gunfights between the surprised boys. Now, if it had been any other color, the orcs would have likely ignored it. But by God, man, this was green. It had to be a sign. And it could only mean one thing, that Gork, or possibly Mork, wished for the orcs to herald a new age of Krumpin by launching a terrible wah, mighty enough to bring the entire galaxy to its knees. Of course, a few of the more dim-witted of boys couldn't make the connection, and so simply yelled excitedly for a few hours before tuckering out and falling back to sleep. Nevertheless, there were three orcs in particular who took this omen very seriously and who each held rather different views on what it could mean. First was Snagger, a runtish, undersized orc whose fellow tribe mates regularly mistook him for a tall grot. Though physically unimpressive and frequently trampled, Snagger was rather bright by orc standards, actually being able to think for a moment before hitting something. Using this big brain power, the little orc thought long and hard and concluded that the green light must indeed be a sign from the twin gods. If he was right, which he surely was, then some boss would certainly take command over the tribes. And when that happened, he wanted to be the first to pledge his loyalty, reasoning it as a path to avoid him being flattened in the coming war. Second was Scrog the Whizhead, a spark-sniffing, spanner-swinging mech boy whose constant tests of trial and error had led him to produce a motley convoy of rickety trucks held together by a few random bolts, and a good bit of luck. To him, the light looked exactly like the ignition flare of a colossal engine, one so large that he began shaking with excitement. For what gargantuan thing could require such an instrument other than an honest-to-God space cruiser? He departed at once, mounting the fastest truck he could find, hauling a ramshackle sled of tools and screaming Gretchen, determined to salvage whatever fell from the heavens and to turn it into something loud, unstable, and mightily impressive. The third was Boss Gorblitz, a towering brute who inspired a great deal of confidence in his tribe, partly because he had caved in the skulls of any who opposed him, but also because he had a boisterous habit of shouting so loudly during a battle that everyone simply assumed he had a plan. He believed that the ominous light marked the location of a threat, and that it must be a terribly large threat to produce such an enormous light. He couldn't rest, knowing that something bigger than him might be out there. And so he started yelling for the boys to shape up and march out, promising them a good fight once they reached whatever lay at the base of the strange mark. For several grueling days, the three orcs made their separate journeys across the nameless frontier. Snagger creeping cautiously over ravines, Scrog putting pedal to the metal as he raced, and Gorblitz smashing every obstacle and sometimes his own boys aside. Inevitably, and with all the subtlety of a rampaging squiggoth, their three paths converged upon the same site. They all had their expectations on what they'd find, but none of them really knew for certain what would be lit beneath the green omen. Closing in, they found that the location beneath the glow was but an enormous crater. Initially, a fight between the three groups seemed likely, but their collective surprise had left them dumbfounded, as at the center of that blasted crater lay the source of the omen. It was a grot. All that hope, all that belief that this was some prophetic sign from Gork and Mork, only for it to be a pathetic little wastrel, a shaking, soot-charred miscreant, clutching onto the twisted ruin of some ancient human tech. The bastard had simply been scavenging through an old manufactorum ruin when it accidentally activated a flare beacon, sending out a luminary distress signal first designed millennia ago. Long forgotten by anyone, except, apparently, the unfortunate grot who pulled the wrong lever. The three orcs at the rim of the crater looked down in annoyed puzzlement. Snagger, though being notably runty himself, hated grots, probably because they were the only thing smaller than him, but this one in particular, for being such a blasted anti-climax to his journey. Scrog, aghast at how much tech had been sitting this close to home, couldn't believe that a Zoggin grot had done so much damage in so little time. Gorblitz, however disappointed he was that they had not found an army to crump, did still spy something rather crotchety to punch. And thus, sharing a quick glance between them, all three reached the same conclusion. The grot died instantly. Some say that the three orcs literally tore it limb from limb, tossing its bloody remains to a pack of hungry squigs. Others insist, however, that the grot simply lost the will to live upon being noticed. But with the mystery of the omen resolved, the three orcs turned their attentions to one another. What was there to do now? The scrap would be a nice prize for Scrog, but it wasn't all that impressive. And sure, Gorblitz could spark a brawl, but why bother? He had taken his anger out on that blasted grot. Yet, as the green flare's last echoes faded across the sky, a sudden thought popped into their minds, or rather, it slammed through them as some form of collective orky revelation. Why should they fight each other when together they could launch the greatest war the world had ever seen? They were all clearly tough enough, and with Snagger's brains, Scrog's machines, and Gorblitz's strength, Gork only knows what they may achieve. And so, in a rare and dazzling display of orky cooperation, the three orcs joined forces. Snagger, technically faithful to his original plan, pledged himself to the boss, earning him a solid smack on the back, which might have actually broken a few of his runty ribs. Scrog affixed the sputtering remains of the beacon to his truck and declared it as good enough. Gorblitz raised his chopper and bellowed an incomprehensible war cry, which the other boys responded in kind, despite not really following the strange turn of events. And thus, the omen, despite being entirely meaningless in the end, had indeed been given meaning, for it successfully sparked what would go on to be a classic and violent war. Twas the night before Candlemas, and all through the hive, not a labourer stirred, none certain to survive. The servitors hung with their vacant eyed stare, cold proof of the sins only steel could repair. The children lay sleepless in rust-eaten beds, while visions of ration cubes danced in their heads. And workers in hablocks, too tired to weep, had whispered their prayers for a painless last sleep. When out in the void there arose such a roar, the hive spires all trembled from basement to floor. I dragged myself up through the ash and the grime, for nothing so loud had been heard in my time. The sky, full of chem fog that drowned out the night, was split by the blaze of a terrible light. More brilliant than star flares, more vast than the sun, I knew in that instant our fates were undone. For there in the heavens, like wrath given shape, hung a vessel whose shadow let no mortal escape. An Inquisitor's flagship, all adamant black, with sigils of judgment carved stark down its back. The vox units crackled with sermons austere, proclaiming our guilt for the whole hive to hear. By writ of his judgment, the message declared, the taint of corruption shall now be repaired. Then the hangar bays opened in silence profound, and payloads descended without even sound. Those cyclonic torches, all humming with hate, fell slow through the clouds like the snow of our fate. I stared at their descent, at that calm, steady fall, and wondered if anyone prayed for us all. For none left below could be pure in their sight. The Emperor's mercy comes only through light. The ground shook beneath me, the air turned to flame, as columns of fire carved paths through the frame of the hive I had known since the day of my birth. A sanctioned correction across half the earth. Yet just for a heartbeat, as death split the sky, a warmth drifted over, and I wondered why. It felt like a hearth fire, serene and at peace, a kindness that soothed as all life seemed to cease. And I thought, though it mad, as ash filled the air, that perhaps in that moment the Emperor was there. Unseen yet relentless, his judgment drew in as the world bowed beneath the great tide of its sin. Then the world blossomed bright in a radiant hush, a dawn without sunrise, a flame without rush. And I whispered a prayer as the blast drew me tight. Merry Candlemas to all, and to all a good night. And so, my dearest friends, our wanderings through the time of Sanguinala, Squigmas, and all other such festivities seems to have drawn to a close. Despite my scholarly nature, I truly have no idea if the denizens of the 41st millennium retell these stories come winter time. After all, the Imperium seems rather more focused on delaying their inevitable demise than of hearing fables of wise orcs and abominable snowmen. Still, for all the darkness of the far future, there is certainly to be found a sense of peculiar comfort in these tales. Everybody, no matter human, alien, or something in between, holds a quiet need for stories, even as the stars begin to fade. It's something rather special to be able to laugh amidst ruin, or to find cause to gather together and spark wonder in one another with little more than colorful words. But such is the nature of this season, where people may take a moment to come together and share warmth with one another's company. And so, wherever you find yourself in this time of Christmas, do know that I greatly appreciate your time and that I wish you nothing but the best for the closing of the year. So until our paths cross again, my dearest friends, I shall bid each and every one of you with a Merry Christmas and with a very warm goodbye.